Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
And a good morning to you. It is Thursday, August 4th, and we are pleased to have a guest in this hour who is running for Congress. Now, I've mentioned the 3rd District plenty of times, and I'm certain that more than a couple of folks are saying, well, do I need to pay attention to this? And you really should, no matter what congressional district you're in Wisconsin or elsewhere, because we're going to hit many issues with Dr. Newman here, as we did with previous candidates and as we will with others. And I would hope that everything that you hear during this hour, both what's asked and answered, might help shape your own questions to your candidates locally. Everybody has their own one or two personal priorities, but I'm hoping you hear something here as well that maybe sparks a concern and makes you think, well, I would typically vote for this person, but do I really want to now that I know their answer about X, Y, or Z? So we're looking forward to covering all sorts of ground with Dr. Mark Newman, who is, again, the 4th of 4 candidates that we are talking to in Western Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. It also stretches into part of Central Wisconsin as well. For those of you not in the area, Democrat Ron Kind was first elected to that seat in 1996. He is retiring after this year. So there are 4 Democrats running in Tuesday's primary. The winner will then run in November against the presumptive Republican nominee, Derek Van Orden, you know, who is on the U.S. Capitol grounds on January 6th. So we'll have a lot to talk about, Mark. But first off, good to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much, Pat.
As I've done with other candidates, rather than my rambling on with a biography, you can tell your story, you know, better than anybody else can. So why don't you take just a moment, introduce yourself to the audience with whatever background you think is necessary, and then we'll get into the issues.
Oh, sure. So I think that one of the jobs, or the job of the candidate, is to help the voters be prepared to vote with confidence when it comes to election time. And when I go to the polls, I have 2 things that are really important to me, and that is I want to know something about the candidate and their character particularly. That usually gets hinted at by what's been their biography, what have they done in life. And then the other issue, of course, is, well, what is that candidate's attitude towards social issues and good public policy? And I'm sure we're going to get into that a lot. But I have to take care of that first deal for us right now, and that is, who is Mark Newman? And I live in La Crosse, Wisconsin, on a river town of Mississippi, La Crosse, Wisconsin. But I was born and grew up in my early childhood in another river town about 200-300 miles further south in Quincy, Illinois. And similar sized town, similar sort of community. But in that community in Quincy, I was able to meet Franciscans who were serving in our Catholic parish. And their life of fraternity and simplicity and no personal ownership and service to others was very attractive to me. So after college, I was able to join the Franciscans, and one thing led to another. I prepared for our work in Africa. I became a physician and was able to go to Zaire, Africa, currently called the Democratic Republic of the Congo. From the mid-80s to the latter 90s, I was there, had a couple of times when I was back in the States, but a total of over 6 years of service in Africa. It was a tough time. It was the dying days of Mobutu, the dictator leader of that country. So when I came back to the United States, I had my tail between my legs, a little bit humbled. And I met my wife in Madison, Wisconsin, and she helped me to recover. And that's how I married into Wisconsin. And my son was born. And then eventually I had an opportunity to take a job with Gunderson Health System in 2010. And that's where I finished my pediatric medical career as a pediatric intensivist, working with Gunderson in La Crosse. And in the meantime, I was getting more and more concerned about our political circumstances. And over the last 5.5 years, I've made an intentional decision that whatever time I have left to contribute in this life on planet Earth, I want to be more engaged politically to help our country simply make our democracy work.
Let me just, before we get into the issues, I want to seize on your overseas work. Yesterday, we talked to Dr. Jillian Bettino, who's running for state treasurer, and she talked about, you know, her work overseas in medicine. My wife has done multiple stints in Africa, in Haiti, and Nicaragua. And none of that is to toot your own horns as you do that. What I'm getting at is, what lessons,
Yeah. What lessons do you bring back to the United States in terms of, you know, letting people know there's a lot of blessings here that we take for granted? There's a lot of room for improvement, obviously, but you know, you've seen, you know, a part of the country where people could only wish to have, you know, what we have here.
You know, I was thinking as you were formulating your question, I was thinking that's exactly where I'd like to go, because my experience in Africa was way more important to me than possibly any importance I had for the people I lived with. And I mean that personally. I went there with these high ideals of being a great physician, you know, almost an Albert Schweitzerian syndrome there. And as I mentioned, it was tough. And what I ended up doing was looking around and seeing the folks that I lived with in a place called Lukafu, who by our American standards would be in pretty dire poverty circumstances, but the folks didn't see themselves as being poor. They saw themselves as being a thriving community. And I had to ask myself, what does this mean to be a thriving community, even though you don't have all the trappings of a lot of sophisticated wealth or technology and so forth? And I learned that there are really four important issues for us. And that is, you know, we need a secure source of nutrition. We need a place we can call our home where we can receive our guests, a shelter. And we need to be able to participate in our community, to be an accepted, recognized member of our community. And we need a purpose in life. And that's what I saw in the folks in Lukafu who were living thriving human, fulfilled human lives. And I said, you know, it's not that complicated, Mark. You don't have to be this great person. You could just be an ordinary human being. And I
exactly.
came back to the United States with that lesson learned, and it has been very good for me.
Exactly. I'm really glad we got to talk about that aspect of community. Dr. Mark Newman is our guest, candidate for Congress in the 3rd District. We'll take a little 2-minute break and be back with more. Remind me to tell you a story about this song Day Tripper by the Beatles when we have a little bit more time on that. Mark Newman is our guest, candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. As we've done with previous candidates, we're going to go through issues, and we'll do them in fairly much the same order so that folks can really kind of compare apples to apples. And so while Dr. Newman obviously has a preference for and a respect for healthcare issues, we're going to hit a couple of other areas first, and we're going to start with the economy and inflation. As we've said before, Wisconsin constituents need a functional Congress for a multitude of reasons. Senator Tammy Baldwin talked to us in our last hour about the Inflation Reduction Act and the many things that that can do to help families who are, you know, trying to make ends meet. So, Mark, let me ask what you believe Congress can do and what you will advocate for to help Wisconsin families and entrepreneurs to have secure economic circumstances.
You know, Pat, I like the way you frame that as we need a functional government. We need a functional Congress in order to face up to the realities that people are experiencing. And the pain of inflation, when prices go up and wages don't go up relatively at the same rate, is immensely difficult for all of us. And that's the world we live in day by day and immediately. And it's the one that we experience to be most disturbing. And, you know, our government does things like monetary policy and some of the things that are in the new Senate bill, Inflation Reduction Act. But I like to go further. You know, these things of supply chain and, what we talk about, you know, trying to survive and go beyond the pandemic, all of these are contributors to the stress of our economy right now. But I like to go further. And that is to recognize that we have a deeper problem in our economy and that we've seen over the last decades getting worse and worse and evolving more and more. And what I call that is the me, myself, and I theory, or the me, myself, and I orientation. We become more and more individualized in our approach to public policy. And the notion that everybody is going to do good if everybody just does what they need to do selfishly as individuals. And what we see happening is we have more and more wealth being concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, and we have no balance against that. I just learned 2 days ago that the three most wealthy families in America and the United States have the equivalent wealth of 150 million people, the lower economic 150% of our economy. And this type of imbalance is, I believe, at the heart of the stress that we feel right now, because the wealthy and the powerful control what goes on in our legislature. And we all know that how money influences the campaign season and how our legislators end up being caught up in that system in order to survive as members of the Congress. They think that they have to carry water for the wealthy folks. And wealth has a way of making itself wealthier. If we have a little bit of power, we can get more power more quickly than someone who doesn't. And the only way to balance that off, that phenomena in every market economy, is to have a strong government that can have a tendency to balance that concentration of power. And unless we can do that, we end up with fewer and fewer people actually pulling the strings and running what we would like to believe is a widely shared governance of the people, by the people, and for the people. And instead of having that, instead of having this dream of democracy, we end up having what we have to call an oligarchy, a functional oligarchy, where the strings and the puppeteers are being pulled by those who have the concentrated wealth.
So what, I believe. Am I hearing, in terms of an economic, impact proposal from you, is it essentially that does it come back to something like, the tax code? We know what we've talked about, what Ron Johnson's impact has been on the tax code, that it needs to be better balanced so that, the super wealthy are paying a fair share, and then that's what funds, the programs that benefit everybody else. Or is there more to it than that?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, you put the hammer right on the nail. We need a progressive taxation formula, and it's like what other wealthy countries do. And people say, well, they have a 70% taxation rate. Well, what the heck? If you have a 70% taxation rate on the higher brackets, but everybody is living a flourishing life, what else do you want? So unless we can do that, and we've done that in the past, our country has had higher taxation brackets and higher earners, but we also have problems that there are many people who are very wealthy, but it doesn't show up as normal earned income that is taxed by income tax. So we have to have other mechanisms. And these are talked about, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, of course, they talk about these things. These are possible, but we have to have the political will to do that. And it's not so much so that we have resources to pay for services, but actually that we are conserving and preserving our democracy to do this.
I think one of the, you hit at something that I think has been one of the biggest flaws in public messaging over the decades, is explaining how marginal tax rates work. That when you had a 70% tax rate, that didn't mean all 70% of your income was taxed. It was 70% of that particular margin, which might be $1 million or more. And that's still a nice chunk of change that's left over, and it's what grew the middle class. Let's turn now to the rural economy. This is a district that remains very concentrated with farming operations, family farms, and then all of the people and the industries that support agriculture. The environment certainly has changed since the days when, Steve Gunderson represented the district, and we talked pretty much just about milk prices. There's so much more to it. So as you've traveled up and down that district and talked to people about what a congressional representative needs to be mindful of for Western and Central Wisconsin's farmers, what are your priorities and plans there?
Well, a lot of public policy for our rural communities comes through the Farm Bill that's been in existence since the 40s with Henry Wallace, when we were helping people to recover from the Dust Bowl experiences in the Depression. But unfortunately, over these decades, it has become more and more advantageous for corporations. And the concentration of power into corporations and the dissipation of support for the smaller operators. And we end up seeing in our countryside that our farming operations are dying. And or I should rather say that the community, the social network, the social infrastructure, the social value is being dissipated, so that from a social perspective, it becomes a bit of a life lost community. We lose small businesses, we lose our churches, we lose our health facilities, we lose our schools when populations are leaving because they have been unable to sustain their smaller operations. And this makes us also vulnerable to stress when we have large operations that are producing a product that gets shipped overseas because that's where the way the Farm Bill sort of favors things. And in the end, it's very understandable to me that people who live for generations in our rural regions can feel that they've been ignored, left behind, and can feel resentful of the way things have evolved. And so what we need is to orient our policy towards the life of people in the rural regions and not simply towards the production of product that we can sell overseas. And we need to counteract the effects of the monopoly suppliers and the monopoly processors that squeeze the small operators just for profits on the supply side and then on the processing side. So it's a definite need. It has to be addressed directly. And it gets back to that same notion I said earlier, when power is concentrated in a few hands, the little guys, they just get ignored.
That concentration of power has also been an impediment to addressing a changing climate, which is important not only to our agriculture, but to pretty much every aspect of life. Tell us what you would do as a congressional representative for Western Wisconsin in the area of climate mitigation and also trying to prevent future harm.
We have a need in front of us to adapt and to mitigate the effects of climate change. I think all of us, even in our short lifespans of 6 or 8 decades, can see definite differences in the weather patterns, which bring it home to us that what scientists have been telling us for 50 years, 40 years, has come home to roost. And so now it's apparent to us that we need to make these interventions. Simply stated, we need to stop producing and adding more carbon dioxide to our atmosphere. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, we had 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide. This is the heat retaining gas in our atmosphere. And now we have 420 parts. We've gone up that much. And a lot of it has been contributed by the American economy, the United States economy over the last 50 to 100 years. And so we Americans have an elevated responsibility on planet Earth to be leaders in the response to this climate crisis that's affecting all 8 billion people that live on this planet. And it's our responsibility to be leaders, to take up that role of the most powerful government in the world, leading the community of nations. When that bleeds back to us in Wisconsin, certainly our federal government is providing resources like we talked about earlier, that Senator Baldwin, with the bill that's before the Senate right now, that would have practical implications and applications in our local state economy to help us transition off of fossil fuel-based energy sources to non-fossil-based energy, so the green sources of energy. It's simple. We just have to get off of fossil fuel as our main source. And we need a lot of energy. That is true. And we just have to move forward and use the technology that's available, but with a concerted and determined effort to get there.
But how difficult that still must be, that, you know, what you just said over the past couple of minutes can be blunted by, you know, a 30-second commercial from the petroleum industry about how, you know, that would be too expensive. We can't afford to do that when we've already got gas everywhere. People hear that and they tell you, I think it would be too expensive. It might cost me my job or higher taxes. In the, you know, less than minute that we have till break, what do you tell them about that?
Boy, once again, you've identified a core issue. What is it, Texaco? I'm thinking which company it was that had a concerted effort to distort the information coming out from our scientists since the 80s. It was Tenneco, where they actually had a campaign of marketing to confuse our public discussion. And that is very unfortunate for us. until it became all just completely unavoidable for people to recognize the danger. And I think that as a government, you can have an authority to stop information, poor information, distorting information that in handicaps the political community to make good decisions.
If only it were that easy to fight misinformation and outright disinformation. That is a battle you and I and others will be waging for some time to come.
That's what you're doing.
There you go. Mark Newman is our guest candidate for Congress. We're going to take our break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with more right after this. You're up north.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Up North News with Pat Kreitlow starts now.
And we start this half hour with Mark Newman, candidate for Congress in Western Wisconsin. Next week on the show, Sean Fedaplace from Main Street Alliance, Angela Lang from BLOC, and State Representative Evan Goyke. And also surely much to say about Election Day, the primary Election Day next Tuesday as we lead up to it. And certainly a lot of talk afterwards about the results. And one of those primary participants is with us now, and we continue our conversation with Mark Newman about the run for Congress. And let me pick up on healthcare is the next topic that we're going to take. You've obviously referenced it early on. We know it's a priority of yours. We've led into it with each of the previous candidate visits through the repeal of Roe v. Wade and abortion and reproductive health care, and whether you believe that this was, in fact, I don't like to say game changer because this isn't a game, but I mean it is a difference maker potentially. What have you heard from potential voters about the significance of that and how it is tied to people's overall need for accessible and private health care?
So did you want to comment on the reversal of Roe versus Wade, or
yes.
Was that it? Oh, yep. Okay. Well, I think that abortion care is part of a comprehensive obstetrics care. And I say that from a professional perspective. It's just standard of care. And people who are learning how to become obstetricians to help with deliveries and help with care of women who carry pregnancies, that's part of their training, part of their whole expertise. And so for us as Americans to deny people the opportunity to receive comprehensive care by itself already poses for me a huge problem. Now, what we've done is we've turned this into sort of a political anguish, unfortunately. And the way I like to approach that is to recognize that there are two things that we all have that no one can take away from us. Now, we might lose friends, we might lose a spouse, we might lose our wealth, we might lose a lot of things, but there's two things that we can't lose, and that's our bodies and our identities. And these cannot be violated. We have supremacy over those two things. And with our identity, it's how we discover ourselves to be, our sexual orientation, our gender identity. This belongs to every individual. It's a discovery through life. And to have somebody impose upon that person and say, it's not like that. You have to be something else. That is an assault on a human being. When it comes to our bodies, the same thing. If someone attacks us, tries to injure us, tries to diminish our experience of living flesh and blood on planet Earth, that's an assault. It is defended against by our legal system. Except, unfortunately, when it comes to our care for ourselves, if we happen to be carrying a pregnancy. When I was a practicing physician, the final arbiter, the final decision maker of anything I did was the informed consent of my patient. My patient had autonomy. My patient had supremacy over his or her physical well-being. And our decision of treatment, our intervention, depended upon that decision, not upon a third party, not upon somebody else imposing And if that imposition was brought in, that could be easily identified as an assault. If I had, if I started treating somebody against what they wished the treatment to be, I was liable for injury of that person. So
I think, do you think as well then, looking at the results from Kansas, it's not that people were so much commenting on whether they supported or were opposed to abortions per se, but it was, you know, a lot of Kansans saying, you don't get to be the boss of me that way with my body.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And I hope that that's the truth, that we can defend our neighbors' opportunity to maintain that supremacy over their own physical well-being, and that they can make those decisions for themselves. You may not agree with somebody else's decision. That's very easy to imagine, but it does not give us a right to interfere with a person's decision to care for themselves. And as I said, abortion care is not extraordinary. It is worldwide standard of care for people who help women with pregnancies, often known as the obstetricians or nurse assistants.
Somewhat related to that is the public health scourge of gun violence. And as you know, recently, the person representing that district right now, Congressman Ron Kind, did not support an assault weapons ban. One of the candidates opposing you in the primary, Brad Paff, has indicated that he would like to see other measures taken instead. But what are your thoughts on what else Congress should be doing, and what will you push for in terms of ending this phenomenon seen nowhere else on earth when it comes to gun violence?
I certainly was happy to see that that legislation was able to pass the House. It's probably going to have trouble in the Senate, as we all expect. And we oftentimes talk about, these are common sense interventions. You know, it makes sense, you know, if we have a dangerous weapon, you know, to limit its presence in our community. But what is common sense is not always the most effective. And so that's where I add to this notion of doing these things like an assault weapons ban and the high capacity magazine, just which is what that bill did, a ban, along with red flag laws, along with broad universal background checks, even licensing of each gun. These all are common sense to me. They make good sense. But I'd like to carry it further and actually do a much more concentrated investigation into what does this health risk really mean to have 45,000 people in our country dying each year from gun injury, gun-related injury. Half of those folks are taking their own lives. But we need to make an intervention and say, do we really understand what's going on here? And then what can we do to make it less likely that so many people are going to die and so many people are going to be injured? We've done that with all kinds of health risks in our history. Just take the example of the presence of automobiles. We're not going to get rid of our automobiles, but we have certainly made a lot of changes over the last 50 years in how we use them and how our roads are constructed and how we instruct young people to be able to get behind the wheel. And we can do that same, those same kinds of interventions by with regard to the presence of our guns. Unfortunately, we have so many guns because they have been promoted by, I think, an immoral advertising program of the manufacturers over the last 20 years. And that might be another place, is to intervene and say, just like we did with cigarette advertising, you know, you can't advertise like that and convince people that in order to become a man, you have to have an AR-15.
I've wondered if we need to go in that direction, if we should go in, if we will go in that direction. And unfortunately, it seems like, if anything, the way our politics are looking on one side of the aisle right now is that they may get rid of the ban on cigarette advertising and say, well, it's all free market. Let's turn our attention next to foreign affairs. As we've said previously, a member of Congress thinks most frequently about their home district, but as a member of Congress, you have to keep your eye on the ball in many different places, whether it's, you know, China or Ukraine or trade with allies and adversaries alike. Rather than my, you know, giving you a pop quiz on each one of these things, I'd like to know what you emphasize and what kinds of feedback you're getting from people when it comes to the foreign affairs that a member of Congress needs to be mindful of.
I'm glad you're not giving me the pop quiz, Pat. You know, one of the problems that we have as citizens is to have really good information about the realities of our foreign affairs policies. And it comes to us through the media. And unfortunately, the media has its desires to sell its product. But and that's where I'm sort of hedging and saying, as an elected, you get hopefully a deeper and more reliable source of understanding of what our foreign policy is in order to be the representative of the people of your district. And when it comes to what should be the direction of our interventions internationally, I reach back to the origin of our American tradition, the original documents and thoughts that led to our revolution with England. And what was it? Freedom and fairness. That is, those are the deeply held American values that have been carried generation to generation, and we tried to implement them in our policy. We failed a lot, but we keep coming back to them. And so when it comes to freedom and fairness or equality, that should be our driving orientation for our interaction with other nations. And whenever our foreign policy is felt and interpreted and experienced as an oppression by another country, then we are violating that basic American principle of respecting freedom. So the opposite of freedom is oppression, when we're not allowing another country to really live their full, their national experience, because we have a desire to whatever, get resources, oil or whatever, that we now impose a policy on another country, disrespecting that country's need to experience the same kind of freedom that we desire for ourselves.
As we've done with everybody, our last couple of minutes will be spent on how some of those issues now are back here at home, where we are looking at oppression, voter suppression, but democracy itself that is under attack by people who are lying about the integrity of our elections. And that will include the presumptive nominee, Derek Van Orden, again, who was on the Capitol grounds January 6th. Should you win the primary on Tuesday, you're going to be on a debate stage with him. What is it that you're going to say to him and to voters about you versus him as the congressional representative in charge of, pledging an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the United States?
I am a member of the Common Council in La Crosse, and so I get to meet and talk with and admire the work of our city clerk. And she is representative of clerks in counties and cities, municipalities, all the way up to the state level, who actually run our election process. And I think when I see their devotion and honesty and concern to do a good job, it is a huge insult to even suggest that they are somehow being corrupted or not being faithful to their desire to have a free and fair election. And this is primary to us as Americans, that we conserve, preserve, and help all of us to be able to vote when the time comes. Louis Brandeis, a justice in the 1930s, said, "The most important office, the highest office of a democracy, is that of the private citizen." And so it's imperative that our government and that our structure of society recognize that the private citizen, all of us as individuals, our right to vote, our right to have a voice in our election of representatives is, it's just ultimately the highest thing that the government has to preserve, and to make it easy for us to get to be able to use that voice and to have it counted.
There's only so many bold predictions that somebody can make in politics, but one of mine is that after this primary with four candidates, it will not be difficult for the Democratic Party in Western Wisconsin to come together and try to hold on to the third congressional district in this particular general election campaign. Dr. Mark Newman, candidate for Congress in the Democratic primary next Tuesday for the third congressional district. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much, and look forward to visiting again soon.
Thank you so much. And thanks to all of your audience.
All right. Have a great day. If you want to follow the show on social media, you just have to look for Up North News by searching for Up North News WI. Don't forget the WI on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. If you're listening to the show and you want to catch us online, go to the Facebook page for our Wausau radio station. It's called Bull Falls Radio because Bull Falls was the historical name of the place. I grew up in St. Paul. That was going to be called Pig's Eye. So sometimes we're happy for name changes. So I'm Pat Kreitlow. We'll have more to wrap up this hour coming up next. You're Up North.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
And we're going to talk about yesterday's newsletter contents in just a bit here. First, a reminder that it's going to be sunny and quiet, not as humid today and tomorrow. Temps in the mid-80s. It was actually a cool breeze, almost to the point where, you know, it woke you up or you had to close the window or something. It was noticeable, but I'm not complaining. Anytime you can have the window open in the summertime compared to 20 below, that is just fine with me. The heat returns on Saturday, maybe a chance of rain in some parts of the state. Brewers lost to Pittsburgh 8-7, but they tried to at least salvage one game of the series in about 90 minutes. They have an 11:35 start time in Pittsburgh and hopefully can, right things that had gone terribly wrong these past couple of games.
I got the MLB app and it notifies me when the lineup gets submitted. And so yes, that submission usually takes place about 2 hours before a game. So I got it in this hour and I was like, what the heck's going on? Why am I getting this so early? And it's an 11:30 game. That's wild.
Yep. Same thing here. So we already know Yelich is leading off, Adames, Tellez. So hopefully these guys can turn things around.
Honestly, Council putting Yelly back in the leadoff has done wonders. And so there was kind of a slump earlier in the season when that change was made. And since then, they've been playing really well. So I trust Craig Council to make the changes necessary. But you're right. These last two games against Pittsburgh, we probably should have had them both. But hopefully we'll get one today.
Oh, I would hope so. And it's one again, baseball is one of those weird things that Yelich credits the change, not just going to the leadoff position, but is doing a toe tap now before he swings the bat rather than just, lifting his leg. And I remember hearing that and thinking, what? And then I finally saw it actually happen during the game. And I thought, sometimes you just need a little something different in your routine. And that can make all the difference. So we'll see if that's what happens. We mentioned coming in that, the Up North News newsletter is an endeavor that I put together after the show and send out usually in the late afternoons. And the way we frame it is we title it with something called Welcome to the State of Wiscommon Sense. And, we just want you to know three things about Wisconsin today. And we also have some amazing photographs that people have sent in. We might tell you who's on the radio for the coming day. And we, of course, like everything that's sent to you by email, we try to come up with a subject line that will entice you to open it if you're not into that regular daily habit. After looking at what was going on in the news yesterday, my feeling was, Rebecca Clefish had a visit from Vice President Mike Pence, and based on the only thing she wanted to focus on, our subject line was crime, 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 crime. Because again, this was held in Waukesha County, no surprise there. And, it was all about violent crime in Milwaukee and Mandela Barnes is from Milwaukee and Milwaukee. And we know what they're talking about here. And I love that Dan Schaefer, a journalist in the Milwaukee area, who writes a great blog called The Recombobulation Area. And if you've never been to the Recombobulation Area, then you've never been to the Milwaukee airport, for which he names it. But he properly noted that for all of the talk, for all of the scare tactics about crime, there's no Republican on the ballot running for sheriff in Milwaukee County. So if Republicans really wanted to do something about crime in Milwaukee, they would go right to the source and tell voters, elect us, we will do something. But that failure to even pretend to actually care about violent crime in Milwaukee should tell you how much of this is really show business and is about scaring the voters. But the Clefish appearance, you know, as we note in the newsletter, also marks now the third time that Pence and Donald Trump have endorsed different candidates in state governor's races. They did so in Georgia, they differed in Arizona, and now in Wisconsin, because tomorrow Donald Trump will be appearing again in Waukesha County, surprise, surprise, on behalf of Tim Michaels. And so it helps inform voters as to, you know, who's moved over to the fringe of the party and who's still in what would be a considered a more reasonable wing of the Republican Party. And it is a party at war with itself. You saw how the Democratic primary for Senate didn't turn into a bloodbath. Once it became clear there was a clear front runner, the party united. But right now, the attacks, often by third party groups, that Clefish and Michaels are going through are quite stunning. Nothing to the level of what we saw in 2012 when Tommy Thompson came out of a bruising primary. I mean, so damaged that he had no resources to take on Tammy Baldwin whatsoever. But still, it's something that's, well, either you hate to see or you love to see, depending on your point of view. So we mentioned that story in our newsletter yesterday. But our number one story of the three things we wanted you to know is that even though Americans have paid into Social Security and Medicare for their entire working lives, Ron Johnson wants Congress to vote every year on whether to keep Social Security and Medicare. He made comments on a podcast that talked about, and he couched it in official terms, of course. You never come right out and say, you know, I want to get rid of, you know, Medicare, Social Security. But what he said is, instead of being listed in the budget as mandatory spending, it should be listed as discretionary spending. Well, that means that every year, you, even though you've paid into Medicare and Social Security, whichever political class is controlling Congress that particular year, sure, they could vote to enhance benefits. They could vote to cut benefits. They could vote to kill the program entirely, which is really not good for the stability of the American worker if they're paying into something and a promise that was made to them, you know, 50, 60 years ago is suddenly not kept because folks like Ron Johnson just don't feel like properly funding Medicare and Social Security. They'd rather give these tax breaks to, you know, billionaires. Again, the billions that could be in the tax code, making sure that the system that workers have paid into is actually working on their behalf. So that was our number one story in our newsletter. Number two was Tim Michaels flip-flopping on whether he would support Trump in 2024. And of course, the Mike Pence visit on behalf of Rebecca Clefish. And then our number three story is that voting can be easy, and please do vote Tuesday. But there are some common mistakes, and we outline what they are so that your vote can be done trouble-free. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we always have an uplifting segment. And in yesterday's newsletter, it was about the cookies. And it's all about where you're going to get something on National Chocolate Chip Cookie Day. We'll talk about some national politics coming up with a national correspondent for Courier Newsroom after this. You're up north.